Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Welcome to the Wandering DMs live stream. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. And today we're going to be talking about dragons, the canonical boss monster in Dungeons & Dragons. Whole lot, surprising number of issues that we just discovered recently about that, Paul.
Yeah, this came up when we were running a game together at TotalCon recently. In case you haven't seen the TotalCon videos, on Sunday morning I run a very short 2-hour D&D game called Boss Fight for Breakfast, which is just meant to be kick in the door and fight the boss and that's it. We play with a battle mat, there's usually very little exploration, it's just a big group of players fighting some really terrible thing or things. And for this year I decided to run the Flame Encounter from Into the Fire, which was a module printed in the first issue of Dungeon Magazine. And then Dan joined me. Dan, you want to talk a little bit about your side of the experience?
Which I was very happy about. So I've heard that you run these Boss Fight for Breakfast events regularly, and everybody that has ever been in it acclaimed it as a really wonderful event. So Paul invited me to specifically play tactically the role of Flame, the giant, ancient, largest possible spell-using genius red dragon in the event. And, you know, it's interesting because sometimes those kinds of single boss monsters can be a bit fragile. Like, they can get beat down by the action economy. And so I was actually really nervous going in that I was going to screw up. And the party was gonna nail me right off the bat, and I was gonna have like a crappy game for them.
Yeah.
But I did like an hour worth of prep work the night before, and the other thing is you didn't show me what the player characters were gonna be like.
Yeah, I thought that would add a nice little veritas to the encounter of the dragon not really knowing that someone was invading his cave but not knowing who or what. So I thought that was fun.
Yeah. It added nerves to me. So they were, we had 9 players at the table, I guess.
Was it that many?
Yeah, I think so. Because you planned on 8, and then one extra person was like, oh, can I join in, I think.
Yes, that's true. You're right. Yeah.
And high-level PCs, and a lot of magic items, and a whole bunch of cold items.
Yeah, I was a little worried about, for a little background of how I started running these things, at TotalCon, a lot of conventions, there's usually either 4 or 2 hour time slots, and the 4 hour morning slot is 8 to noon. And if you're like me and you hang out with people until 2 in the morning drinking the night before, you don't want to get up for an 8 a.m. game. You just don't have the energy. So I said, how can I cram something into 2 hours? And so I started running these boss fights. So generally the crowd I get is a pretty casual crowd, right? They're people who are like just showed up or were up late the night before and they want something a little light to fit that morning slot before they get into like real crunchy gaming at 1 in the afternoon. So I was very nervous actually presenting that kind of player with here like 8th, 9th level characters. Try to wrap your head around that.
That makes sense.
It worked pretty well, I would say.
Oh, I thought it worked very well. I mean, that was my favorite thing of the convention, and so I feel like the main discovery coming away from that you and I both had independently is that there's no way we could have done that with just one of us. Is
true.
The complication of that level of monster with all kinds of abilities and all kinds of spells and all kinds of tactical choices. I was happy not to be adjudicating the player actions. And, you know, explaining stuff and managing saves and answering questions about spells and stuff like that. And I think you were happy not to have to manage the huge technical buffet of options of the dragon. So I think that was like if I had future boss fights, that would now be my favorite way to handle it, of have one dedicated rules adjudicator and one dedicated monster runner.
Yeah, I mean, it worked out really well. I would say when we were first talking about, hey, maybe we can use this 2-hour boss fight game as an experiment on 2DM gaming,
yeah,
which is something I think you and I are both always interested in finding new
right.
ways to do.
Right.
You know, when we talked about that, I said, well, this is the easiest way to do it because I can imagine doing it without you. So, if, you know, worst comes to worst, I could still run it.
There you go.
And in hindsight, I'm like, no, I don't think I could have run that all by myself.
Yeah.
That would have been too much.
And if you care about it, like, so if I had been there, right, mm-hmm. so you're going around the table with the 9 players, and they have questions, and they're moving, and you have a battle map, and you're answering questions, and you're making adjudications about roles and stuff like that. And so if it had been me, like, all my mental energy is on that, and then once it got around to the monster action, I would feel compelled for pacing purposes to make a decision in about 5 seconds about what to do.
Right.
And so instead of that, I got to just sit there, listen to what the players were trying to do, and meditate on my options for about 5 to 10 minutes as it came around the table. So basically, and I had a deck of your spell cards to help me out. And so basically, I think that increased, like, it increased the total number of processor cycles by about times 200.
Yeah.
And so that comes off looking like a much smarter, much more dangerous opponent than just the first thing that pops into my head in 5 seconds.
You know, the funny thing is, because now I'm going to dive deep into, so we've both done a little research before this, I think, you know, went and read the different versions of Dragons, because
yeah.
the thing we really want to talk about is how interesting it is that we sort of had different assumptions about how Dragons work. So what I noticed, so I read OD&D, I read BX, I read the Monster Manual, and one thing I noticed is that they all have that I've never used is a die roll to determine what kind of attack it makes. So every one of them is roll this die on this value, they'd use their breath weapon. On that value, they'd use their normal melee attacks.
Yeah.
And I've always immediately discarded that. It's like, that's dumb. I'm going to role play the dragon and do the most tactically sound thing.
That's a good point. That's okay. So to be clear, in the middle of this wonderful, wonderful game, Paul and I, right in the middle of it, discovered we had totally, completely different instincts about how dragon rules worked, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I should say that it's unusual because, as we said before, I was running OD&D games and you were running BX games with some house rules, and people started to ask us, what's the difference in your games? And we thought about it and we couldn't come up with anything.
Yep.
It's effectively the same game. And so we got in the habit of thinking that it was the same game. And then we are astonished right in the middle of this game that we're about to have a rules fight
yep.
in front of the 9 players over how to run dragons. Now, this issue just brought up about the die roll for how it behaves from turn to turn wasn't it. That wasn't
yep.
the main thing.
Correct.
We didn't even think
nope.
about.
Nope.
But
nope.
I did mention it, if you recall, I did mention it right at the start, right? I said, by the rules, there's supposed to be this die roll, but we're going to skip that, right?
Okay, I don't even remember having that conversation,
yeah.
but it probably...
Yeah, I very briefly noted that and agreed
yeah.
that certainly for this game, that wasn't the way to do it.
You know, I think it's something that I sort of knew in the back of my head existed in the book
yeah.
and that I've always just discarded it. And the funny
yeah.
thing is... what I found surprising is that it is one of the few consistent things between the different editions. Every
That's
edition has that rule in there. And I was like, wow, huh. I wonder if, so to bring it back home, I wonder if that's because they encountered exactly this problem in play that, like, oh, I have to think about so many things as GM. When it comes around to the dragon, I don't have time to think of tactics for the dragon. Let me just roll a die.
Well, that's really interesting. I might take a stab at, like, you know, the dragons, although it's one of the last things that you encounter in a D&D game, you know, it might be one of the first things they wrote, and I don't know if they were, like, in a more gamey mindset at that point,
yeah,
that more stuff is going to be based on random die rolls rather than less later on. Now that I'm on that thought, I'm starting to lean into Matt Finch's thesis that is the opposite of what I just said.
Mm-hmm.
And I would claim that early on there was more die rolling for stuff and less role playing stuff. Anyway, so that might be my stab at why there's that weird thing in dragon behavior uniquely.
certainly, well,
there was a lot to unpack in that sentence. I apologize. That was a dense sentence.
What? Yeah. Now, trying to think of how Matt Finch plays into this. Okay. What I think you'll hear from me over the rest of this discussion, a common theme is that I think in pretty much all the editions that dragons are overly codified, and generally I prefer to ditch a lot of that.
Okay, that's interesting. How about I express like the rule that I'm most familiar with from original D&D, sure, and then you ping us with what you have seen or expect to use in BX at least.
Sure.
So in original D&D and consistent with advanced D&D and Holmes Basic, which is the thing that I personally started with in 1979, is dragons have hit dice and they also have an age table. And for each dragon you run into, you roll one single die, and either 1 to 6 or 1 to 8, depending on the edition. And you look up in the age table, and there's a lot of flavor in the age table. It's like if you're young, that you're 12 to 20, it's a dragon 12 to 20. And if you're very old, you're 400 to 800 years old or something like that. And that one die roll dictates the number of hit points for every single die. And that number is also the fixed number of hit point damage they do from a breath weapon. Mm-hmm. So you have this age table with some flavor. You have this one single die roll. It's a little weird that as a result of that, dragons come in these fixed categories. So in original D&D, there are only 6 possible hit point values for dragons. And it's a little bit easy to predict. If the DM happens to say, here's an adult red dragon, an expert player can immediately figure out the exact number of hit points it has and the exact damage.
I have a wrinkle to add for you that I've only discovered just the 20 minutes before this conversation reading the books, which is I believe that in both OD&D and AD&D, although I think it really comes out in the Monster Manual, that there are in fact 2 axes of variables for dragons. There is age and there is size.
Right.
Now, also, all dragons
but
have
the size is only one single hit die in difference.
That's the interesting thing. Okay, so here's the thing I find fascinating, right? So the text says something about like the size that the size is some way associated with the hit dice, but I think in OD&D it doesn't really tell you how or why. But if you look at the dragons, all of their hit dice range are 3 steps.
Right.
Right. And then if you get into the Monster Manual, it then says, I think, there are 3 categories of size, and you should roll for it. And here's the dice to roll for what size they are. And maybe I'm blurring this together. Maybe it's BX that has you roll for that.
Right.
But either way, like as I was reading each of those things in series, I went, oh, I see. The number of hit dice constitutes the size, whereas the age gives you the hit points per die.
Yeah, that's a good. What I see in original D&D here is it says 20% will be small, 20% will be very large.
Yep.
And then it's a little ambiguous. No, it says the number of dice is an indication of the size of the creature. So there's a little bit of interpretation there,
right. You have to sort of go, oh, I see. Well, I should roll a percentile, and then if I'm in the bottom 20% or the top 20%, I'll go to the high end or low end of the hit dice. Otherwise, I'm in the middle.
Right.
But I think that the Monster Manual lays that out more explicitly. I think it's the Monster Manual where it says, like, you should roll a D8, and on this result it's small, and on this result it's big.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
That sounds right.
And I never really realized that until I went, wait a minute, as I was connecting this, I went then and looked at every single entry and realized every single entry, the hit dice, is a range of 3 values.
Right.
I hadn't noticed that before. Anyway, that's interesting. I thought that was an odd point that I had never really dawned on me before. So to that end, I think
you're totally right. The other thing is most everybody interprets the OD&D language on breath as although the hit points and the breath damage are the same number, they're logically 2 separate things. And as a result, in OD&D and AD&D, most people do not reduce the breath damage from the dragon taking itself damage.
Right, and that was the crux of our difference of opinion at the table, because in BX it very explicitly says that the damage does go down as the dragon takes
And coincidentally, I will point out that swings exactly in the direction of the way that we were both incented. So my expectation from OD&D of full damage all the time is certainly what I wanted as playing Flame. And your expectation of BX with the damage going down was the last thing that I wanted to hear right there at that moment.
Now, of course, I also use D8s where you use D6s for hit dice. And so you were, I think originally when we talked about it, you were like, so I'm going to be doing 66 hit points of damage, right? And I was like, no, 88.
Right. Well, you're right. Yes, right. So there was a little roller coastery for me.
Yeah. I just want to go back before we dig too deep into that. I just want to point out, like you had mentioned earlier, that like, oh, if you, there's only a couple of hit dice values. So if you see an adult red dragon, it's not enough information. I need to know, is it a big, is it a large adult red dragon, or is it a small one?
Right.
But I still, I don't know. All that rubs me the wrong way. I don't want to be describing how old and how big. I mean, dragons come up so rarely. I'm going to ask, really, how can a player look at a dragon and go, that is an ancient red dragon. Oh, no, that one is very old versus young. I don't know. Seems silly to me.
So what is maybe explain to us what is the BX rule in contrast to OD&D for that?
Sure, I have it right here. Great. Okay, so first of all, in BX, no hit dice range, right? They're all, every color is a specific hit die value. End of story. No age cap.
Which happens to be the same as the middle value in original D&D.
There you go.
Yeah.
Quickly flipping to dragon. So then the other thing is it says. Says the number of points of damage a breath weapon does is equal to the dragon's remaining number of hit points. Any damage done to a dragon will reduce the damage it can do with its breath weapon. And I'm trying to remember, does it have me roll the hit dice for hit points, or is it just numbers by age?
I think it's just like standard monster hit dice,
yeah,
right?
I think it is.
So
I think
any other monster, you're going to roll 10 dice or whatever.
Yep. I believe that's
there's no age table, right? Am I right about that? There's no table saying younger.
Correct.
Right, so that's gone. And then they have that little wiggle room of you can like adjust the number of hit dice to taste more or less under the aging paragraph.
Yep.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah.
As for my personal preference, I don't like any of these rules. I don't like. I would rather see damage of a breath weapon be rolling of dice. I would like to see it. So the proposal I think I made when we were chatting about this over email was just roll their hit dice, right? If you have an 8 hit die dragon, it does 8 dice of damage when it breathes and roll the dice. And my reasoning for that is, one, I think it adds some interest, a little variability. That's kind of neat. So maybe this gust is lesser than the previous gust. That's more in line with other big, powerful magic spells and whatnot. And I would say it's a tangible, exciting moment at the table. Anytime a wizard player or the DM scoops up a handful of dice and starts shaking them and says, "The dragon breathes, shake, shake, shake," there's tension there. And I feel like you lose that when you just say, well, it's got 75 hit points left, so 75 is the damage.
I'm sympathetic to that, and I think there's also a spectacle aspect of rolling all those dice. There's this big cascade and clattery noise, which kind of simulates the chaos that's happening at that moment. And I actually do agree that dropping a giant load of dice on the table kind of simulates that a little bit better than just saying, "Hey, it's 66 points right now."
So that's, I think, in future, if I were going to run another dragon encounter, that's what I would do. I would say, breath weapon is variable, roll the dice.
Okay, so you're not bothered. So when we were on email, of course, my instinct was more complicated than that. And I never, being accustomed to the age table, I didn't think about getting rid of that. And so my instinct, and I've had this pasted in my book in the past, was to roll one die for age category, have that determine a expected number of hit dice, which could be higher or lower, roll that number of hit dice, and then that number divide by the average per die to be the number of dice that this particular dragon does per breath weapon. So you're not worried, like, with your protocol that you don't have, like, a really, really large dragon hit points, and then you're rolling the same amount of damage for its breath as any other dragon?
Honestly, Dan, you lost me there with the complexity of the math. So,
oh,
so already I'm like, oh god, do I have my calculator out? Do I have to write notes every time I want to play a freaking dragon?
Okay. So let me snip that up.
Yeah.
So presumably when you roll hit dice for dragons, that's the proposal, right?
Great. Yep.
Okay. So sometimes you have smaller dragons, and sometimes you have larger dragons as a result, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you bothered that they're all rolling the same number for damage?
No, right. So you're talking about, like, I happen to roll very low for the hit points, but then I roll very high for the breath weapon, and maybe that's weird that such a tiny creature produces so much damage. No.
Exactly.
I can roll crappy hit points for my 11th level spellcaster and roll massive fireballs. What's the difference?
Well, yeah, okay. So it's hard for me to break out of this whole age category concept I'm stuck with.
Yeah. Again, being from BX, I'm kind of not used to there being that table. Now that said, again, my background is a weird hybrid background. When I go back to like what I grew up with and what I'm used to using, what I'm really used to using is BX plus the Monster Manual. So that adds some weird complexity to it. So I'm certainly aware of the age categories, aware of all these extra rules, right? And then having to reconcile that and having to be like, oh, the basic book says this, although it's almost ridiculous that the basic book even includes dragons. You're going to throw dragons at third level characters? That's insane.
Right.
I suspect they included it just because how can you possibly publish a game called Dungeons & Dragons with no dragons in it?
Right.
So I'm used to having to reconcile that, and ultimately, I'm sure at some point, probably at a very young age, I went, this is too complicated. I'm not dealing with this age nonsense.
Okay, and kind of lean more on the BX stuff than the Monster Manual stuff.
Sure, or even go the step further and just say, well, I'm just always going to customize, because tell you what, dragons are so rare. Every time I put one down in a game, I tell you what, it's not going to be because I randomly rolled them on a wandering monster chart. They're going to be the featured monster of this dungeon, and so I'm gonna really customize the crap out of it.
Yeah, that's pretty reasonable, and you know, it's a common critique sometimes of the whole game Dungeons and Dragons that you've got dragons in the name, and then it's so really incredibly rare to actually use or see dragons in the game because they're a top end monster.
Yeah.
And because they're so incredibly dangerous to characters that you actually see them pretty rarely. So it's kind of a common critique that you have a whole lot of dungeons, but you don't have very many dragons as a rule. So I'm sympathetic to if they're that unusual, that's totally fair game for the DM to customize it any which way they want. That makes a lot of sense.
Brian has a question for us of do any of the books give physical dimensions to the dragons?
Well, this is a great question. So right before we got on, so the background that's behind that you see behind Paul right this moment is the famous Tolkien illustration of Smaug, where a lot of our instincts for red dragons come from. And I was telling Paul that last year I spent a rather inordinate amount of time one day with a ruler measuring the scale of Smaug and Bilbo and the ladders and the steps and the pots to come up with a Tolkien-esque estimation for how long Smaug should be.
I'm gonna hopefully this doesn't make people sick. I'm gonna move the picture a little bit so maybe you can see Bilbo. It's not working.
Just in front of his face there.
Yeah. There it is. There's Bilbo.
There he goes.
Okay.
And when I was doing that, I also ran into a quote from Tolkien saying that he kind of regretted making Bilbo too large in that picture. So my whole scaling estimation, I think, was kind of flawed to begin with. But to answer Brian's question, so in original D&D, there are no dimensions for dragons. That was added in the AD&D Monster Manual for the first time. And they're pretty big. They're on the order of like 40, 50, 60 feet long. And interestingly, there is no modification for age. So they have fixed sizes in the Monster Manual, and they don't relate to the creature's age. So presumably that's the adult.
Well, again, I will point out that I'm pretty sure Now I'm getting out my monster manual. I'm pretty sure that it directly associates number of hit dice with size. Yep. There are three general size categories, small, average, and huge, according to the size typical of each. This categorization is determined by a die roll. An 8-sided die is rolled, 1 to 2 is small, 3 to 7 is average, 8 equals huge. This size dimension indicates the number of hit dice the dragon has.
Yeah, but that, okay, agree. Totally true. Yep. That's hit dice. I think Brian's asking about, like, physical dimensions. So if you go...
Right,
you,
but, you go, but it corresponds to huge, right? Huge, small. Weren't those categories in the...
No, if you go to any particular dragon listing, look under size, it'll say large, and there's a number of feet, and there's just one fixed number there.
Interesting. Yeah. So how do you reconcile that with this variable die roll of size?
I quote John Peterson when he said, "These things were loosely reckoned," which is my current favorite quote in D&D scholarship.
That's great. So, you know, the other thing I couldn't find in the Monster Manual as I was digging through it is, what is the Monster Manual's rule on damage for breath weapon? I couldn't find it. Is it in here?
What?
Yeah.
It's got to. It's...
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't want to send you diving into the book, but I was... Yeah. No, granted, I wasn't, like, being super careful here. Sending Dan to the book.
Yeah,
sorry,
okay.
Dan.
No,
I will try to vamp while you dive through the book.
The interesting thing, I think in a lot of cases, there's a criticism that I make sometimes is that to Gygax, these games were all continuous. Mm-hmm. So I would make a pretty strong argument that in Gygax's mind, and sometimes he would explicitly say this, you know, original D&D and AD&D are all one consistent path of one game. And so I think a lot of the time, he knew rules in original D&D in his mind, didn't bother to copy paste them into AD&D, and would say, "Well, that's odd. We already all know that, so I didn't bother to write that there."
So while Dan tries to find the damage that a dragon does in his monster manual,
And the interesting thing, sorry to interrupt. Yeah. The interesting thing is it's hard to find, and I have it circled in pencil. It's on page 30 under the table of like elemental types.
Yep.
It says the breath weapon causes damage equal to the dragon's hit points or half that amount if a saving throw is made on each and every creature hit by the breath weapon.
There you go. All right. Then.
Notice that it's entirely ambiguous. That doesn't say one way or the other about whether it should be the full hit points or the current hit points. Yep. And so, whereas in OD&D, I think it's at least arguably clearer, in AD&D, completely 100% ambiguous if you just read that text right there.
Well, I think that's why there's so much debate over it, right? Is that you have two texts, OD&D and AD&D, where it's ambiguous, and then you have BX, where it's very explicit. And then the question is BX being explicit because it is making explicit what used to be assumed, or is it explicit because it is different from the baseline?
That's an interesting argument, and I kind of like that. My take is that he kind of had to do something different once he got rid of the age table.
Right.
Because the OD&D rule references the age table and says, look at the age table for hit points and look at the age table for breath damage. And once the age table's gone, Moldvay and BX had to do something different to make up for that, would be my thesis.
So,
nowadays.
Another interesting thing I noticed with my reading that I did just before this, one of the things you asked prior to us actually running the game was, what should we do for saves? And I noticed, and I don't think I'd ever noticed this before, but that...
saves of the dragon.
Yeah, yeah. What kind of bonus, what kind of saving throw bonus does the dragon get? Like, typically, I think you and I both play with just plus hit dice, right? Whatever their hit die is, that's their bonus.
Which is a problem in original D&D terms, because you have this giant variation in hit points and size, even though it's on the paper, it's the same number of hit dice.
Right. So I noticed there's a section in the Monster Manual that says, in order to determine the hit dice for the sake of saves, you should divide their hit point total by 4, because that way a much older dragon will save as a higher hit die creature than its raw hit dice.
Right, which is an approximation of the average number of hit points per die, which really ought to be 4.5 there.
So again, which brings me all the way back to the fact that this weird two-axis age versus size and all the math I'm supposed to do around this, I think, is ridiculous, and I don't want it.
You know, that's you got to respect that, right? It's weird, it's wonky, it's unique for dragons. I'm used to it, but so the prior sentence that got overly complicated with a bunch of divisions largely comes out of that thing that you were just referencing, is that I'm accustomed to thinking I'm going to look up hit points and divide by four or something to assess other stuff. And it's weird. It's weird. It's unusual. There's nothing, no other monster like that.
Yeah, that's very strange. Very strange. You know, the other monster that I compare it sometimes to that is also, I'm much more likely in my own games to sort of diverge from the written rules and just start customizing is demons. And I don't know why that is, and maybe it's just I haven't spent enough time poring over the monster manual and really sinking my brain into where demons are supposed to be. But I feel like with both demons and dragons, they're so unusual and they're so exciting and interesting to face that I feel like I kind of almost owe it to my players to tweak them and tune them a little bit to make it an exciting moment.
That's fair, and there's some tradition for that because demons specifically, I think in Strategic Review initially, there was an article about here's a bunch of tables for random unique demons, and then that shows up in the AD&D DM's Guide in appendix.
Right.
There's an appendix, whatever the hell it is.
And someone has made a wonderful online generator webpage for that. I'm not going to remember where the heck it is, but it's great. I love that thing. I love that thing. Right. Give me a random demon. Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, and I agree. I think that's a great idea. And if they're creatures from the realms of chaos, and then they should be all different and unpredictable. Yeah. The particular tables for me tend to make really nonsensical stuff. And I mean, I guess so maybe that's what D&D is like all the time. And then as the DM, you have to like find some way to make this a comprehensible. It's a great idea.
Yeah. So interesting thing I noticed though is. So all this comes down to like, well, when do you put dragons in your game? And mostly what I'm talking about is intentional placement, right? They're there for a reason. They're a major NPC or they're, you know, a boss of a dungeon. When I've played using the OD&D sort of wilderness random monster charts right out of the book, I've consistently been surprised at how often dragons come up.
Okay. And this is really fascinating because I was someone was asking me about this at an event last night. This exact issue, and I was committing to being to not commenting on this issue. But it sounds like your investigation, Paul, is that dragons randomly appear in the OD&D wilderness tables.
That's my, again, I have no data to back that up. Just in my experience of having run it, I've been surprised when I use those tables, the frequency of rolling dragon.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just luck on my part. I don't know. But it did seem like they show up more frequently. Have you done any analysis on that, Dan?
No comment.
Interesting. Interesting.
This is currently an issue in my campaign, I'm interested to hear your impressions on that issue.
Fair.
And it's also interesting that your preference is to specifically locate them, and so possibly anyone who has played with you in the past, that might possibly be their impression as well.
So the way I've handled this in my own games, often it comes up because like my characters are, there's no way they can handle a dragon when it shows up. And frankly, I then flip that in my head and go, likewise, the dragon probably thinks that the players are pretty insignificant and is just gonna move on by unless they like really stick their nose in. So usually when I do roll that, I'll have something like, oh, a dragon fly, you know, you see the shape of a dragon flying overhead and the players like duck for cover and that's the end of it.
We had, you know, so in the distant past when we were co-DMing a campaign, and I wouldn't remember this except for our mutual friend BJ. Well, I guess maybe you remind me of this recently. We had a random dragon show up, and we were going to do that fly by them, and then BJ's character, who was a lizard man, intentionally called on it, called it down, negotiated, wanted to open negotiations with it. This is third edition, so there's a diplomacy check, and he rolled a natural 20, right, on that diplomacy check?
Is that what happened? I think it was something like that, yeah.
So we were planning on that same have the dragon fly by, and then one of our players says, no, come down here. And we were like, what? And then the result was even more surprising. So that's the game. We did not expect that to happen.
Okay, before we run out of time, Dan, I think the last thing we really ought to cover is Subduel.
Oh, God. Okay, wait. I'm going to say that there's two... Okay, there's two things. Number one is the question of breath damage. I've run a couple polls online.
Yep. Okay.
Right? And so I asked in an AD&D group on Facebook and got about 150 responses. And now, this is AD&D. The responses were 84% no, do not reduce the damage when the dragon gets damaged. Mm-hmm. And I also asked it in an original D&D discussions forum, and I currently only have 12 votes, but it's about the same results. There was 75% that said no, don't reduce that. So that's the standard interpretation, at least, of the ambiguous language in OD&D and AD&D. Most people don't reduce it, and I think for me that's at least a little bit of an argument for me not to do it. Is I do kind of want my games to be most of the time what people are expecting from standard D&D. So that's actually there's interesting tactical arguments for reducing it, but there's at least one argument is people expect it not to be reduced, and you don't reduce damage for other monsters, and you don't want to make dragons too weak. So there's at least one data point for me from those polls I did.
Yeah. And I think again, in my own personal opinion is I probably wouldn't run it that way again. Right. I would roll because that's what I want. What I want is the drama and interest.
Okay.
I'm not tied to like, oh, there's interesting tactics going on when there is, right. It certainly changes the flow of the game a little bit.
Yeah.
But it just, I don't know. I think it really just means that tactically your dragon really should be breathing for the first three rounds because, you know, it's only going to get worse. So might as well get all massive breath weapons out as soon as possible. So I think it actually is more interesting to not have it go down in terms of the number of tactics open to your dragon.
Okay.
But I want to add the interest of some variability in there. So I'm going to go to dice.
I like that better. I like that better than the number going down from the damage. That would be easy for me to get on board with.
There you go.
That's a good idea. The other thing
before coming soon to OED. No.
What's that? Say it again.
So it's coming soon to the next version of the OED DMs. Guy.
I'm on the fence about that.
Yeah.
I think I feel that I mean, personally, like, I don't want to surprise people and I don't want to be too off book, but that is an issue that I think is the dragon rules are really wonky and weird.
Yep.
And I think that would be an improvement.
Right.
My
question is, like, would you codify it in the house rules that you show to players, or would you, as someone who publishes a set of house rules for others to run by, would you rather leave that to DM interpretation?
I would want to codify it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm someone who feels the rules matter, so I would like to codify the standard, and then if DMs individually want to make things unique, of course they always have the right to do that. And for unique boss monsters, they even more have the right and responsibility to do that. But I would probably want to codify what the standard is in my world.
Yep. And which way are you going? You're going with just max hit points?
Currently, yes.
Okay.
I mean, I don't even have that in the house rules because I feel like that's not a thing that needs to be said. That's actually just the regular original rule. But yeah, that is currently how I currently run it.
Okay. Great.
Yeah. The other thing I should point out, so just give me like a minute and I'm gonna do a little statistical diversion, and I apologize for everybody if this isn't coherent. So one of the interesting things is that where in original D&D you roll one single die and it's easy to predict whether the number of hit points come in like six different categories, whereas in BX you roll an actual maybe 10 dice, and there's a whole lot of different more possibilities. The weird thing is that statistically, the variance is greater in original D&D because you might, like, if you have a 10 hit die red dragon, you could easily have a 10 hit point dragon or a 60 hit point dragon are equally likely as anything else. Mm-hmm. Whereas in BX, your dice curve is bell shaped, and you're almost guaranteed to get something in the middle around 40 hit points. And so weirdly, in original D&D, even though there's fewer categories, the variance is higher, and therefore it's potentially a riskier event because you can one-sixth of all dragons have 60 hit points. Whereas in BX, when I did the math, only 1 in 60 million dragons could have 60 hit points. And so there's a big... So like your expectation, Paul, I think at one point is... Maybe this happens to be one of the dragons that you rolled maximum hit points for under your rolling dice protocol.
Right.
And my response to that is it's almost impossible because only 1 in 60 million would have that.
Right. But
so, yeah.
But my assumption at the time was if you look at some old modules of that era, yeah. A lot of times the monsters have hit points that defy the laws of probability. I know this, especially what jumps out in my head is like L1, which is one of my favorite modules, but somehow all of those monsters manage to always roll max or max minus one on every die. And I assume that's just because the author was like, no, I want this to be dangerous. So I'm going to go on the high end of what is reasonably possible. So likewise, I could see someone writing Into the Fire and saying, no, again, I know this isn't true because now I know that the book just tells you it has this many hit points. But I could see someone going in there and being like, I want this to be the biggest, baddest dragon the rules allow.
Yeah.
So therefore, what's that number?
Totally fair. 100% totally fair. The one thing I would add is the fact that whereas in OD&D, having a max-sized dragon is very frequent, switching to BX, if you roll a dice, it's almost impossible. Yep. That's why... So here's Frank Mentzer's companion rules from 1984. So in these rules, for higher level characters starting at level 15, so he has these expanded options for dragons, and there's a picture of the biggest dragon you're ever going to see right here, whereby he expands, he dictates a large and a huge size that up to doubles the hit dice, thereby probabilistically recreating the largest size the dragons you see in original D&D. But the problem is, he's got this text here, it says, considering the entire race of dragon kind, those given in the D&D basic set are small and weak. And I'm like, Frank, don't tell me my dragons are small and weak. That's foul play. But he did that there so that he could double the hit dice, so that he could recreate the large size dragons that you used to have, that you would have in OD&D.
Is that because he's fighting BX rules, or do you think that's because he's just dealing with general number inflation? That, we're now pushing levels and everything up to these numbers that didn't exist in the game prior.
Definitely both.
Yeah.
Good point.
Okay.
Good observation. I think it's definitely both. It's high. He's dealing with high level characters, and he's stuck with, he can't just dictate all the dragons are all ancient or anything like that.
Yeah.
From what I hear with like Gygax and Arneson, like a lot of high level players, had multiple dragons that they were using as mounts because they had captured them with the subdual rules.
Excellent. But before we get into the subdual rules, I want to really quickly answer Brian's question. He asked, did we give Flame any extra actions to make up for the one versus many economy of that encounter? We did not. We went by the book. But that said, we did give him some minions. So he had a group of lizard men slaves, I assume, to help fight off the invaders. I definitely recommend anyone check out that module and read that encounter because it's brilliant. The caves, the detail of the caves is great. There's all kinds of traps that Flame has set up for his defenses. There's just really interesting. Flame's horde is incredibly detailed, which I find really cool.
Yeah.
So
in a campaign, that would be like a real highlight.
Yeah. So honestly, like a big part of our game there, in the opening gambit was sort of watching the players walk down what appeared to be a long empty hallway, which is of course like three layers of traps is what's really going on there. And I started the game in round sequence where I just said, we're going to play in rounds this whole game. And it's round the table. And at the end of that, going around the table is Dan. And I said, I looked at Dan to ask him sort of implicitly, what do you do? And sometimes he would hand me a spell card, or sometimes he would say, I think, at some point you said, throw the trap now! Pull the lever.
One thing we didn't mention is you didn't even tell them it was a dragon to begin with, right?
That's right. They did not know they were facing a dragon. They knew they were facing something very large, intelligent, and powerful. Actually,
and spellcaster. You specifically said said probably a spellcaster.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm sitting at the end of the table with this big deck of spell cards, and the players are being very, very careful coming in, and as they're being careful and a little slow, that gives me a bunch of rounds to cast extra preparatory spells.
Yep.
And I was trying to make that obvious. So I was trying every round that they were being careful gave me an extra spell to cast. Yep. And I was trying to make it dramatic and obvious when I said, handed the card to Paul of here's the thing that I'm taking advantage of this round. And so by the time they actually confronted me, I had like three illusions going. Yep. And it was really hard for them to pin me down to begin with.
Yeah. To their credit, though, the going slow really helped them defuse that initial trap. And when you read the module and you read that initial trap, you can see that like a group who's just going to run down the hall and sword swinging, they are screwed. That's a nasty trap to fall into.
It is. And I was upset that they were doing as well as they could, because the way the adventure is written, it expects the first thing that's going to happen is this trap's going to spring on them.
Yep.
And they were totally 100% foiling that.
Yep.
And so I had to make an audible call to hit him with something else first. And I had to just go, the trap is not going to be the first thing that happens. And I've got to get in front of them. And frankly, the main thing I was trying to do at that point was I was trying to distract them, hit them with something horrible, make them forget about the trap that they found, and then run past it and catch them. And that didn't really happen either. Yeah. They were too good.
I mean, you did get in their way a bit with the trap, but certainly the trap didn't cause the amount of damage you would expect it to cause. Though, again, you confuse the crap out of them, I think, because by the time they knew they were facing a dragon, you had mirror image going, your heads were poking out of another illusion, so all they see is a whole bunch of dragon heads floating around in front of them and breathing fire at them, and they're like, what is that? Is it a hydra? Is it a... What's going on?
And then came the three cold spells.
Yeah, I did make sure that I gave the characters plenty of stuff to be able to deal with the dragon. Usually my boss fights are much lower level, not much lower level, but like 5 to 7 rather than 7 to 9. And the first thing I noticed is I just quickly did the math and said, oh, the first breath weapon attack on this group is going to kill them all immediately, even if they make their saves. And so I went, okay, I'm going to level them up. I want at least a couple of them to be able to survive with a good save.
I'm dealing with the same thing, actually preparing for a game at our event next month. The Tomb of Horrors predecessor. I'm dealing with that exact same issue, actually.
Yep.
For particular spells. Yep.
The other thing that I will offer up as advice to folks facing that is I always bring at least 50% more characters than are required. So for a table of 8, I bring 12 characters, and I tell them, look, here, there's extra characters in here. And if things go badly for you in the first hour, we're going to have a B team show up.
Great.
So
great.
Yeah.
Great. At least one person had to grab an extra character, if I recall. So they were running in at the end there. Yeah.
Yep. We did have I want everyone to get to play. Like if it's 10 minutes left and somebody dies, I'm not giving them another character. But if somebody dies 50% through the game, then I mean, I want them to have fun. I want to bring them back in.
You did that really well, by the way. Because things got faster paced near the end, and someone did something, and you just said, "That's it, you're done, you're dead."
Yeah,
and
I was looking at the clock.
Surprised, but that was the perfect call for pacing purposes. That was the perfect call in the last 10 minutes.
Yeah, I didn't want to deal with trying to roll in a brand new character with 10 minutes of play left. Yeah. That's foolish. Yeah.
The other thing, I'm just going to gloat a little bit because one of my favorite things is they hit me with all these damn cold spells, right? And then on my turn, I taunted them. I went, "How dare you bring cold into my lair? I am vulnerable to only two things: cold and magic missiles." And I had a scarab of protection that makes you immune to magic missiles. And sure enough, I actually did trick one of the players in using their next round to hit me with magic missiles that I was immune to. And I was really peeved, Paul, because I thought it was just going to be, oh, you hit them with magic missiles, right? And I could play act like, oh, no, don't throw me in the briar patch. And you said the magic missiles stop 5 feet away and disappear. And I'm like, no, that's no, yep. My whole plan is ruined.
Yep. I guess that's always how I've interpreted that, is that it's a physical shield. It's a thing. It's a screen in front of you.
You screwed me on that one.
I assumed you were also complaining about cold so much because you also had protection, a cold protective item, right, which reduced the cold damage. Not enough, though, as it turns out.
In that edition, it doesn't do a lot. Yeah. It's one point per die, and that's not a whole heck of a lot of protection.
Yeah, it's not a ton.
Sometimes I feel like that should be more, but...
All right, we are really going long. Are we going to touch Subdual here?
What's on your mind about Subdual?
I don't use it. It's dumb.
You know, okay, so here's one of the, okay, so okay, here's, so I think that theoretically I would go by the book, and here's a criticism in a bunch of places of D&D, is the Subdual rule, so the unique rule whereby you can pound down a dragon with the flat of your sword and then have it surrender halfway through to you. It only exists in the monster manual, or you know what? It's only in the monster book. How are the players supposed to know about it?
Yep.
So there's this one unique tactic that is only existing in a book that theoretically the players shouldn't be reading in the first place. Yep. So it's a mechanism that can only come into play by expert players if they've read all the books. And so that's one of those things that I criticize, frankly, of people, you know, some expert players go, why didn't you know to subdue it? Well, not everybody's read every single book, and there's no way for players to know about it. So I've never had it come up, you know, because I don't know at what point to say, oh, players, it is an option uniquely with dragons to get it to surrender to you. And so because of that, I've never had any players ever say, we're gonna try to subdue it.
And I worry about the precedent it sets, right? It's going to open the door like, oh, can I do this to other creatures? Can I do this to a hippogriff? Can I do it to a griffin? Like, I don't want to go down that road. There are other interesting ways to end up with a pet dragon, right? There are plenty of ways. You know, I could find an egg and hatch it. I could use a charm monster spell. I could polymorph an obedient dog, right? Like, there's so many ways to end up with a pet dragon. Why do I need this special subdual system?
That's a great point. That's solid.
So what are your thoughts, Dan? Are you going to use it if it ever comes up?
It's a great question. Theoretically, yes. As usual, I'm a little aspergersy, and if it's written in the book, by default, that is what I'm committed to doing. And no player has ever said that, and I'm not entirely sure, unless my players watch this particular video, that any player would ever, you know, and I tend to play with newer players, which is more fun for me, frankly.
Right.
And I don't know how any player would ever know that. For a bunch of just like they, you know, burning oil is only in the DM's guide, and a whole bunch of tactics are only in the DM's guide. So I don't know how it would ever come up. But theoretically, it's a rule, and I would follow it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, amusingly, in your long-running outdoor spoliation game that you've run time and again at HelgaCon, our group does in fact have a pet dragon, which I think we got through charm. I want to say,
yeah,
is it charm?
Yeah. And you were prepared. You went after it, and you had a whole bunch of charms prepared one after the other in case it saved. So
Yep. And then just treated it well, right? Like once the charm was in place, just treated it well, so that by the time the charm ran out, it was like, yeah, you guys are all right. Like
that is exactly what happened. It was really interesting to see how committed you guys were as a team to like you know, considering how badly some things get dealt with. Like, we really have to treat this dragon super well. And like, what does it want to eat, and where does it want to live, and let's make a lair for it and give it some treasure. And I'm like, this is like the most team oriented committed task I have ever seen. Of like, keep this dragon on our good side.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's, boy, you were, that was, I gotta say, that one's successful, because boy, you did everything. Yeah. And the funny thing is, like, the character of the dragon is still not, it's not 100% trustworthy. There's still a little streak of, like, still something, there's a little thread of something could still go wrong, which I like.
I mean, I assume it's still inherently evil and egomaniacal and, like, I'm really just a terrible, terrible kind of person. Now, yeah, he's an asshole. He's our asshole. I don't know. I don't know what to make of that. I'm surprised that some of the players who play the more sort of righteous, lawful types are okay with it.
I think the cool factor wins on that. Is that there's no one at the table that wants to be known as the person that lost the dragon.
I guess that's fair. I guess that's fair.
Yeah. Yeah, when we were running the flame boss fight for, you know, so the event title is Boss Fight for Breakfast. You've run it a number of times. I was running the flame when it got to me. I was running the character and I was taunting the players. And a couple rounds went by, and one of the players stood up and went, "This guy's kind of an asshole," pointing at me. And I said, "That's our next event, asshole for brunch."
That's great. I missed that exchange. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Well, you see, that underscores how busy you are as DM with that many players. I mean, you were dealing with other stuff. Yep. You didn't have time for that.
No. Yeah. Well, and I really enjoyed the fact that you thought to taunt them and roleplay the character, bring the tactics. Like, it's all stuff, I think, that made that encounter super fun. I would definitely run that again. That was great.
That was my favorite thing at TotalCon. Awesome. I want to do that again.
Awesome. We'll have to find a reason to do it.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, cool. So, final thoughts on dragons.
They're unique. They're complicated. In retrospect, their unique rules are wonky and weird, and I'm very sympathetic to wanting to smooth them out to look more like other monsters. And your idea of, you know, rolling dice for the breath damage has, you know, a lot of surprise and a lot of spectacle to it, and I'm very very sympathetic to wanting to smooth that out.
Yeah, my opinion is, some people call later, like, first edition, second edition, maybe AD&D, it starts to become a bit baroque compared to original D&D, where everything has got extra codification and extra curly cues and extra detail. And I generally don't want that stuff. I feel like dragons are the first place in OD&D where we get a taste of that, and so I am very ready to reject it out of hand.
That's a really good argument. And you can, in OD&D, you can compare other monsters. Goblins are two lines,
yep.
And gnolls are two or three lines. And then dragons uniquely come in and they're three pages.
Yep.
And you're right. It does kind of open the door to a wall of text that's really hard to interpret, frankly.
Yeah. So that's where I would bring in GM Fiat. You know, there's everybody always talks about the loophole the size of a Mack truck at the beginning that says you're the DM, do what you want. And that's what I would do. That's what I would do. However, I would say if I was running a game with another DM, I would make sure to go over this stuff ahead of time. Turns out, it's a little surprising when it comes up at the table.
Well, you know, one thing I wanted to end with, like, to ask our viewers is, like, maybe anybody watching this can think, if you're familiar with original D&D or AD&D, they're pretty similar, versus BX, is there anything else you can think of that Paul and I are going to run into someday that's going to surprise us? Most everything is the same. We know about the class differences. When you run BX, you still allow multi-classing and stuff like that. But if anybody can think of anything else that is radically different that's going to cause an argument right in the middle of one of our games, please leave a comment and tell us and help us out on that. And then maybe we'll make a future video about that too, so we don't run into it by surprise.
Yeah, and please do leave any of your thoughts about dragons in general in our comments. Tell us about how you've used them, or tell us about interesting snafus you've encountered with the rules as written, or ways that you've tuned your game to include dragons. Always curious to hear that kind of stuff. Please drop us a line. Leave some thoughts in our comments.
Dragons are a big topic, and this was a fairly big video. So I hope that we covered enough to be interesting with that. Fred, thank you so much for the comment right there. It was one of my favorite games. I'm so glad we did that. Any other final thoughts that you have, Paul, at this point?
Nope, that's it for me.
Great. So as always, please subscribe to the Wandering DMs channel on YouTube. That does help us out a lot. We are live every other Sunday at 1 p.m., so please come back in 2 weeks. In 1 week, there'll be another Dan in Peru video where I make some random ruling about something I saw on a mountainside. But in 2 weeks, please join us for another thought-provoking discussion, and we'll talk to you next time.
See you then.